Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers podcast. I'm your host, David Latchman, and before I introduce my next guest, there are a few things I need to say. This is going to be the final episode for this season, but don't worry, we'll be back. Preparation for the next season is on the way, and I'm already booking new guests. We also have a podcast blog. You can find a blog at sciencebloggerspodcast.com. That's all one word. And some of our most recent episodes and show notes already up. And eventually all the past episodes will be there and their show notes. During the show's hiatus, there will be some blog posts related to podcasting. So if you're wondering how to get started or what equipment you might need, or why you should choose certain types of equipment over others, then these articles are going to be for you. And hopefully it will help some new science podcasters create their own new shows and get it out there. And on to the show. My guest today is Irene Antony. She is a science blogger with a background in medical microbiology. She runs a blog, Living with Microbes, where she writes about the various microorganisms we encounter in our lives. And she'd like everyone to know the impact these organisms have on our existence. So, hello, Irene. Is that hard to pronounce your name?
No, not exactly. It's Irene.
Irene. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So, Irene, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. And thank you for having me on this show.
It's great having you. So why don't we start by telling the listeners a little something about yourself and what you do?
I am a science blogger. My blog's name is Living with Microbes, where I write about the microorganisms, and I have a master's in medical microbiology.
Okay, and you're from Abu Dhabi, is that?
I live in Abu Dhabi, and I'm from India.
Okay, so what brought you from India to Abu Dhabi?
It's my husband's work.
Okay.
He works here, so yeah, I followed him.
What does he do?
He's into oil and gas field, so he's an engineer.
Oh, okay. So you have a background in microbiology. What got you interested in that field?
My bachelor's was a little bit general. So during my bachelor's, I took a subject as microbiology. From that, I got inspired. For example, they are so tiny. We cannot even see them with our naked eyes. But according to me, they are the most versatile organisms. But mostly people understand or relate microorganisms only in the context of disease. Yes, I totally agree that microorganisms causes infection and produce disease, and it's an awful experience. But other than that, they are employed in a lot of industries. For example, if you take the food industry, microorganisms are over there. They are in the fermentation of yogurt and cheese. They are in the meat industry, wine industry, everywhere. And if you take the textile industry, they are there to for the separation of jute and in the process of separation of the fabrics. And when we take about the oil and gas industry, they are over there to mop up the oil spills. So overall, even though they are very small, they're everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not that knowledgeable about microbiology or what these various, you know, bacteria and viruses do. But I know some people were saying that our survival sort of depends on them. Like, for example, as you mentioned that we ferment foods with it. And because we ferment foods, it allows us to get more nutrition from the very foods we eat. So,
yes,
you know, they are very versatile and helpful organisms in ways that we probably haven't thought about or imagined.
Yeah. For example, for example, we eat a lot of, people say like we should take a lot of probiotics, which is full of good bacteria and help us with digestion. There are certain foods we eat which cannot be digested by our own digestive system. For example, foods which are rich in fibers, especially the plant foods which are rich in fibers. Those foods we cannot digest by, it's very difficult for our digestive system to digest it. So the bacteria which is present in our gut helps to digest those foods.
Right. And I don't think there are any larger organisms like we are that can actually digest fiber. I think it's only bacteria that can do that. Is that correct or is that wrong?
I'm not quite aware of it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So your blog, Living with Microbes, why did you start that blog?
When I was doing my research, I was a very passionate and enthusiastic researcher, but unfortunately the research couldn't I couldn't balance my family. You know, research is very demanding.
Yeah, it is.
It needs full commitment. It's not like an 8-to-4 job. So because of the family obligations, I left the research field. At the same time, I didn't want to move completely away from this microbiology field. So that made me a blogger. So this platform gives me the freedom of doing what I love. Without compromising my family's needs.
Okay. So what sort of response have you gotten towards your blog? Are people more fascinated by microorganisms? Or is this something they didn't know about?
Initially I got a very good response from the audience. And one more thing. Because of this current situation, the pandemic going on, I think people got more interested in microbiology and they want to learn more about the microorganisms, which is a personal benefit for me because I write about the microorganisms. So, I launched this blog at the right time, I guess, even though I was behind it for some time, I launched it on the correct time. So, I am getting a good response.
How long has your blog been around?
Now it's been 5 months.
5 months? That's pretty cool. And it's still going.
Yeah.
What are some of the articles you write about in your blog?
I mostly cover the very basic things so that someone who doesn't have a microbiology background can also easily understand. So I don't write about the in-depth information. So I just basically cover basic things why bacteria infect us, and are viruses a living organisms? And my recent post was about the sterilization of hospital equipments.
So viruses, are they alive or are they dead? Well, not living.
It's a debatable topic. But the thing is it's about how we define life, because according to our classification, we define life as you need to be born to have a life, but viruses are not born, and you need to have a reproduction, you need to reproduce, but virus doesn't do that even though they replicate their genome, and viruses doesn't have a biochemical autonomy because they hijack the host completely on the host cell for their biochemical requirements. So when we consider all those criteria, I have to say viruses are not alive, as in the sense how we are alive. But they are living organisms if you see in the aspect of replication, having a genetic material. So, it's a debatable topic. Is it a living or a non-living? But mostly, scientists consider viruses as a gray area between living and non-living.
Oh, and that's interesting because, it's so weird, especially with, this pandemic that's going on, that you know, this.
Yeah, that word. Because when I say viruses are not alive, people will be like, and this non-living thing caused all this pandemic?
Yeah, it's, you know, it, and we study the behavior of, you know, this virus as it moves around the world. So,
yeah.
You know, in a way, it seems to have this sense that it's a living organism that, you know, wants to replicate and survive. You know, it has that intent, you know, but,
yeah,
you know, it's just a bunch of, like, either DNA or RNA that's going about something.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, we can say like that.
Okay, so one of the articles that I was looking at on your website was on a certain bacteria. I'm probably going to, like, get this name wrong. Is it Thermus aquaticus?
Thermus aquaticus.
So I got it sort of right.
Yeah.
So what exactly is this bacteria and why is it important?
See, this Thermus aquaticus was first isolated from a thermal spring, which means the growth conditions of this bacterium is like high temperature. They can survive high temperature. And since they are thriving in this high temperature environment, the enzymes isolated from this also survive high temperature. So that's the highlight of this bacteria. So after the discovery of this bacteria, almost 20 years later, PCR was discovered. I assume you know about PCR?
Somewhat, but why didn't you talk about it in case someone else doesn't know?
It's a polymerase chain reaction. What basically PCR does is, like, it amplifies a certain piece of DNA. So for that it's like it's kind of how replication happens inside our cell. It's like a DNA is replicated into a new copy. So in the PCR reaction, it's done in a laboratory with a controlled conditions. So in this PCR reaction, they are like, we need to use a particular enzyme which helps in the process. But unfortunately, like when the PCR was invented, an enzyme from another bacterium called E. coli were used. But this E. coli enzymes were not heat stable. PCR reaction carries out at high temperature. So every time, like this PCR, it's like we can run cycles. So for each cycle, the scientists had to reload the enzyme because it's not withstanding that temperature. So after 1 or 2 years after the discovery of PCR, the enzyme from the Thermus aquaticus were used in this PCR reaction, which was revolutionizing, because this enzyme can withstand high temperatures, and it doesn't have to be added in each cycle. So that's the highlight of this bacteria.
Right, so I guess because it doesn't have to be reloaded for each cycle, it means you use less of it and the process is more efficient?
When you say it uses less, it's not like that. Because when we have to add enzyme each time, it delays the process of the PCR reaction. Normally, a PCR reaction will happen in like around 3 to 4 hours, depending on the what gene you are amplifying. So today, like, we can finish a PCR reaction on an average of 3 to 4 hours. But if you're adding enzyme at each cycle, it takes a lot of time. So that is the one thing. And efficiency, yes, efficiency means if the enzyme is not withstanding high temperature, it is useless. It doesn't serve the purpose. So this enzyme is isolated from a bacteria which lives in a thermal spring. It can withstand this high temperature.
And, you know, it's kind of fascinating that you wouldn't think that studying, you know, this type of bacteria would lead to this kind of discovery. that will help make PCR, the discovery of PCR, that much better. You know, it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, that is the, I think that's the beauty of research, because one scientific discovery will lead to another, and that one will lead to another. It's not like a one scientific discovery is going to help you.
Yeah, and I don't know what it's like where you live right now in terms of research, but at least here in the US, sometimes you'd see this debate crop up that we should only do research that has some sort of tangible benefit, right? It should have some sort of goal, a definable goal that you can say, okay, I'm doing this research and we're going to make this discovery, or we're going to use this discovery in this way, right? We shouldn't be researching a wombat in, I don't know, wherever, right? And I'm pretty sure the people who discovered, you know, Thermus Aquaticus knew that they were going to discover this enzyme that can be used for PCR. You know, it's science doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah, because like, yeah, we cannot, like, for example, if we one, like, for example, I can say from the history also, like the antibiotic penicillin, it was not discovered because they were looking for an antibiotic. It was discovered as a part of another research. So likewise, we cannot expect the scientific discoveries to be like in a single direction. One discovery will lead to another, or like in the process, it will help the other researchers.
Yeah, it's, you know, we don't know. It's, but, you know, as they have often said, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, what that means is that we use the work of others before us. And that's how we make those discoveries. They happen incrementally until we discover something like really amazing that revolutionizes things. You know, that's how it works.
Yeah.
So, sterilization of medical devices, how exactly do you do that?
See, for example, these hospital equipments like the endoscopes and other highly sensitive equipments cannot be sterilized how we sterilize the metal instruments. The metal instruments such as the surgical instruments we use for the surgeries, like the forceps, scalpels, all those things, they can be sterilized by putting it in a wet autoclave and during like applying a wet heat sterilization. Wet heat sterilization means you apply steam at a temperature of 121 degrees Celsius, which is intended to kill all the microorganisms. But these instruments, the endoscopes, they are they have this, they are lensed equipments, because they used to, like, they can be used to see inside of your body. So these lensed equipments, they have some limitations to, we cannot heat it 121 degrees Celsius. So for those equipments, we need to apply another kind of sterilization, like low temperature sterilizations, like applying some gas or vapors, some kind of like that.
Right. So, you know, we have to adapt it to the need of the material that this instrument is made of.
No. It's like material is important. Yeah, you are correct. Material is important. But moreover, we need to adapt to the risk factor of these equipments. For example, if you are using a stethoscope, it's like a low risk equipment. It's just we are not doing really sophisticated procedures or anything. It's just used to check out your, it's just applied on your skin. But some instruments, they enter the sterile body cavity, they get in touch with your blood, they get in touch with the mucous membrane. So depending on the risk category, we should classify the sterilization methods.
Wow, sounds really complex. Something I'll think about next time I'm in a hospital or I have to visit my doctor, and hopefully everything will be sterilized and safe for him to use.
Yeah, that's what we mostly think about, the needles. Like we look at the phlebotomist. Is she taking a needle from a new packet, or is she reusing the needle? But we don't think about how these equipments, like the endoscopes or the surgical instruments, are they clean or are they sterilized?
Yeah, and you know, it's so important to, you know, think about how these instruments are being cleaned, you know, especially the environment in which they are being used, because there's a lot of pathogens, you know, around there that can kill people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And then, you know, when you're looking at, you know, drug-resistant bacteria, you know, you have to make sure that, you know, these bacteria are not on the instruments that you're going to be treating people with, otherwise it could be a bad thing.
Yeah, true.
So you've been a science communicator for, I guess, a relatively short period of time. So do you have any thoughts about, you know, how to effectively bring your message across to people that need it?
First of all, I think we should come out of that scientific bubble, because we need to really break down. Like if I'm talking about someone from the microbiology field, I can talk about terms like pathogens or sterilization or anything. But if I'm talking to someone who's not from a microbiology field, I really need to break down those terminologies. I need to talk to them in their own science communication. Then only the science communication should be effective. That's one thing. And one more thing is, like, we need to get the participation of the people in the research. Like, when talking about science communication, usually people talk about getting funds for the research. That is absolutely correct, because you need funding for the research. Without that, research cannot go on. But during my research, I had the necessary fundings. I had all the research equipments, reagents, everything. Behind was the to collect the blood samples, to convince the people to give their blood to my research. So to get people's participation, or people have to have confidence in your research. Otherwise, research cannot go on. So science communication should achieve these things.
And, you know, you're right, because, you know, not many scientists see it as important that they should communicate science, or someone within their group should communicate science to the general public. But it's important, not just, yes, you need funding for your research, but, you know, so many decisions that we make today, you know, around the world are going to be based on science and technology, and people need to be informed to hopefully vote on those decisions. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, because many of, like, I don't know about other fields of science, in microbiology and whatever research I have done, it includes a lot of sample collection. You need to get people's participation. So some people are they're not aware of it. If I try to explain to them, they're scared. What am I going to do with their blood sample? Or that kind of scary feeling. And some people, they are what are the immediate benefits? They're thinking about the immediate benefits. Like, we are doing this research for the benefit of the community, but people are expecting an immediate benefit. So to make people understand all these things, we need to communicate science in their language.
Yeah, and that can be difficult at times.
Yeah.
So who do you imagine is the main audience for your blog right now?
Right now, I'm covering the basics of microbiology. So my main audiences are people who are interested to read about microbiology, but not from the microbiology field, and I have like minority of audiences from the undergraduate students. Yeah, those are my audience.
So basically, like people like me who have no idea or anything about microbiology, and people who want to learn a little bit more because that's the field that they want to get into.
Yes, correct.
Something like that?
Yeah, correct. Something like that.
So the research that you did, what exactly was the research that you did before?
I worked on the association of HLA genes with rheumatoid arthritis. HLA genes, I can break it down. There's a protein called MHC molecule. It is a cell surface protein present on the surface of the cell, and it captures and displays the antigens so that the T cells can come and attach to it. So this MHC molecule is coded by a gene called HLA gene. These genes are associated with the rheumatoid arthritis disease. And these genes are highly polymorphic, like they vary among the one, they vary from one ethnic group to other. So I studied the association of these genes with rheumatoid arthritis among Omani population.
Wow. So, okay, so this gene, okay, you said it's polymorphic and it varies among different groups.
Yes.
So you basically, you have a bunch of genes that all lead to the same disease. Is that correct?
No. Like, what did you mean by a bunch of genes? Bunch of HLA genes, you mean?
Yeah.
No, it's not like that. These HLA genes, they code for this protein, MHC molecule. So according to the variation or polymorphisms in this gene, the gene codes for this protein, so that variation will reflect on the protein and it affects the display of this antigen.
Okay.
So rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease. Autoimmune disease means your body mistakenly attack your own cells.
Right.
So if this MHC molecule is not capturing and displaying the antigens properly, you might get an autoimmune disease. So this HLA is linked to a lot of autoimmune diseases other than rheumatoid arthritis as well.
Oh, okay. So it's that particular variation that leads to rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes, there are other risk factors also, but this is one of the the greatest risk factor.
Oh, okay, because I thought that there were different variations that led to one disease rather than one variation that led to this.
Oh, no. No.
Now, as I said, like, this is like completely new to me. I know nothing about this.
Okay. You are from which science background?
Physics.
Physics.
So it's very
difficult topic.
Very different. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I know the basics, like what a bacteria is, what a virus is. You know, if you ask me, I can give a somewhat accurate response.
Yeah.
You know, but when you start going into in depth, I'm like, wow, I know absolutely nothing.
But we all are like that only, because whatever we studied in the high school, it will get rusted over time. If you ask me something about physics, I'll be like, yeah, I had studied something like that in my school days. But yeah, it's like that only. It will get rusted over time.
Yeah. Well, I don't think like I did that much microbiology in high school. I mean, we covered the basics and that was about it. So, you know, like the really advanced stuff, you know, I have no idea what's going on.
Okay.
So the future of your blog, what direction do you see this going, you know, short term and long term?
I started with blogging because it's the platform which gives me some kind of confidence Now I'm thinking of starting a YouTube channel, as YouTube is a very powerful and popular medium. So yeah, it's already in the pipeline, so you can soon expect a YouTube channel. Also, I had plans to conduct workshops locally in Abu Dhabi, but because of the current situation, I think for some months.
Yeah, it might be a while before things get back to normal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the YouTube idea is a good one. For one, you know, you can do it online. And if you need to reach out to people, then you have that platform to do everything virtually. And I think a lot of science communication is going to go in that direction, because we can no longer just get people, a lot of people, into one room and talk about science. We're going to have to do something new.
Yeah.
But I look forward to your YouTube channel when it comes out.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
So just tell me. And, you know, the other thing too, I don't know if you watch a lot of science YouTube videos. Do you?
Yeah, I watch, yeah.
Yeah, I think like one of the major problems with science YouTube is the lack of diversity on it. It's usually men that tend to do it. And that sort of leads to a problem that, you know, of visibility. You know, if you're trying to reach kids and get them interested in this, you know, you're going to think as like, well, this person isn't like me, so maybe I can't do this.
Yeah.
So we need a diverse group of people doing this. So I hope to see you there as well, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
So is the YouTube channel going to be called Living with Microbes, or are you going to have a new name?
Oh, no, I'll use the same name, Living with Microbes.
Okay, well, I look forward to it. So
thank you.
I think, you know, we've discussed like quite a good bit of subjects. Is there anything, any subject that you would have liked to talk about that, you know, we didn't have a chance or we didn't get a chance to talk about?
I think we talked quite a lot of things. Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, we can start closing right now. So why don't you tell people about how to find your blog or find you on social media or get in touch with you if they need to.
Yeah, okay. So hello, everyone. You can find my blog. My blog's URL is livingwithmicrobes.com. And I'm there on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. So please be in touch with me. I cover the basics of microbiology. So even though you're not from a microbiology background, you can easily understand. So yeah, that's it.
Okay, I'll be sure to include all of that in the show notes. And, you know, thank you again for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I know it's late at night where you are.
It's 8:36 p.m.
Early where I am, because I'm in California. Right, it's about 9:36 a.m. here, so...
Oh, okay, so it's 11 hours difference. I think you're 11 hours behind me.
Yeah, so time zones, so strange.
Okay.
But anyway, thank you for doing this, and I hope you have a good night.
Yeah, you too. Have a good day.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Iron. Be sure to check out her blog, Living with Microbes, for some really interesting content on microorganisms. And please like, share, subscribe, or leave a comment on this episode. Anything you can do to support this podcast goes a really long way. And be sure to check out our blog at sciencebloggerspodcast.com. There is going to be new content during the hiatus, and you'll also know when the new season starts. I hope you'll join me for the new season, when I bring you a new set of science communicators.